Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you on this Wednesday, the 4th of November. Welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, President Pierre Nkurunziza tries to persuade Burundians to hand in their illegal firearms.
When you see the kind of, again, targeted killing, extrajudicial killing that are going on every day in Bujumbura now, I think it would be very naive to think that, you know, if you give back the gun that you have been using over the past month, nothing going to happen to you in today's Burundi.
And singing for peace in South Sudan.
We have tribes, 64 tribes. But my dream was to bring the people together.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
Violence is flaring up in Burundi. A police spokesman said on Tuesday that 9 people have been killed in gunfights with security forces since Saturday. Burundi has been rocked by months of violence linked to President Pierre Nkurunziza's successful but disputed bid for a third term in office. Nkurunziza has given Burundians an ultimatum. They have until November the 7th, that's this coming Saturday, to hand in illegal firearms or face criminal prosecution. I've been talking to Ben Shimuni, an analyst with the Department of International Development at the London School of Economics and Political Science, about the possible impact of this new measure. But first, I asked him who was being targeted in this latest round of violence. Was it mainly government officials?
It's very hard to say because we have very scarce information on what's going on. I think it's more Nkurunziza himself and the kind of cronies and close allies around him who are targeted around this attack. And of course, the police, rather than the army, the police itself is viewed as very close to the president and very supporting of the president. So I think this attack are mainly targeting toward the police. The second hypothesis is, of course, a revenge killing. You have to see that we have had some kind of regular targeting killing across town in order, in a way, to punish the people who demonstrated against the third term. And this could be seen as well as kind of targeting revenge killing.
So, in other words, tit-for-tat killings between government and opposition supporters.
Yes, definitely. I would say one of the main dimensions of it. And the second might be as well, just, you know, a kind of hope that this is going to trigger something bigger, something wider, maybe, you know, encouraging people to take up arms. So I think those people who are doing this attack just want to keep the pressure on Nkurunziza.
You referred to taking up arms there. Now, President Nkurunziza has given Burundians until November the 7th, that's this coming Saturday, to hand in illegal firearms or face reprisals. Now, will his security forces be able to enforce this deadline?
Well, I don't think so. At least on one hand, they might try. On the other, I think the kind of, you know, discourse saying, well, you, if you give us the weapon now, we're not going to be prosecute you. I think that has absolutely no credibility. When you see the kind of, again, targeted killing, extrajudicial killing that are going on every day in Bujumbura now, I think it would be very naive to think that, you know, if you give back the gun that you have been using over the past month, nothing going to happen to you in today's Burundi. So I think it all depends on how the police can basically track down this individual, discover weapon. But I think I wouldn't give much credibility to this statement.
So it's not going to have much impact, this measure?
No, I don't think so. Just because I think the people who are currently having this weapon, who are currently, you know, attacking police and things like this, are already in a logic of no return, I think.
Last month, Uganda tried to revive talks between the government and opposition in Burundi, but it appears that little headway was made. Why is mediation in this conflict so difficult?
Well, I would say there is two main reasons. The first, I think that from Nkurunziza's perspective, I think that he is convinced that replaying by force is needed, that some killings are needed, some kind of targeting killing and purge of the party, maybe purge of the army, and purge even of civil society, of any challenge. So he's not ready to negotiate just because he don't want to use negotiation at this point. I think it's still in his interest to just use violence. And in a way as well, it's to prevent maybe larger mobilization that could occur if there were a truce, you know, if they start negotiating, if, you know, violence is not used in the same way by the state, then, you know, people can mobilize, et cetera, et cetera. The second one, I think, you know, when you look at the kind of discourse that Nkurunziza, or rather that the party, the CNDD-FDD, have been using, in a way, they have been trying to portray external actors as undermining the sovereignty of Burundi. They have called, you know, the Belgium cooperation and even Belgium as a country as a neo-colonialist because they dare to cut aid and they dare to criticize Nkurunziza governance. So I think they're trying, you know, by in a way demonizing the external actor, or at least, you know, not taking into the in account their recommendation. They may be trying to mobilize people around this idea that basically Burundi is a victim attacked on the diplomatic scene by a range of nations as well.
You mentioned external actors there, and last week US President Barack Obama said that Burundi would be ejected from the AGOA pact, which gives African nations access to US markets. Do you see sanctions like this having any impact on the regime in Burundi?
To what extent this is going to lead Nkurunziza to change his current policies, his current use of violence? I don't think so. Because again, I think for him, the main danger would be a kind of, you know, rebel group being created by these young people taking up arms. And for him, the challenge is very short term. And so actually, he's not ready at this point to hear any or to be sensitive to any economic sanction, because his problem is much more short term. It's about violence.
Ben Chimuni from the Department of International Development at LSE in the UK. People crave information in a crisis. Their livelihoods, well-being and perhaps even their survival could depend on it. But in Burundi, reliable sources of news are few and far between. Private media outlets have been ransacked and closed down. Media professionals driven out of the country. Burundians, though, are clamouring to find out what is happening in their country and want media outlets that have been shut down to reopen. Ante Dideste Niragira from the southern province of Rumunga has sent us this report. It has been adapted for Africa Link by Christina Kripal.
Information is an important part of life in Rumunga. The more information people get, the less anxious they feel. Phones and social media are their main sources of news, says this man called Philemon.
We have phones connected to the internet. This way we see what is happening elsewhere. And sometimes we get calls from people in the capital Bujumbura to tell us what is happening there.
Listeners in Rumonga deplored the closing down of private radio stations 6 months ago, which killed off their traditional source of information. Another Rumonga resident, Frederic, says they want the stations to be reopened.
Radio Bonesha FM, which is not on air anymore, used to keep us well informed. We would like every radio station to reopen, but it seems to be difficult.
Attacks against private media have caused a large number of journalists to flee the country. Those who stayed now work under very difficult conditions, like Jean de Dieu Nsengiyumva, a journalist at La Radio Télé Renaissance, one of the media outlets which was set on fire and pillaged.
We have difficulties accessing information ourselves. If we ask someone in authority, we are told no. You are being punished. You cannot have the information. But the main problem is security. It is true that this is a problem for everyone in the country. But journalists in particular are being targeted, physically attacked and intimidated by youths who support the government.
Most people in Rumonga are not aware of the difficulties being faced by the journalists, says Frederic.
We had no idea.
But both the general public and journalists agree that the media outlets have to be reopened and media professionals must be allowed to work in a secure environment. Many media professionals are still scarred by the violence they were subjected to in the past month. Leandre Sikuyavuga, chief editor at the Iwachu Media Group in Bujumbura, told DW what happened.
We were attacked above all during demonstrations. Our cameras and tape recorders were confiscated. Some journalists were threatened. Most of the threats came from the police because they didn't want us to take pictures, although that is part of our job.
Ante Dideste Niragira wrote that report.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
Elections in Central African Republic, scheduled for December, are part of a plan to restore democratic governance to the country. But it is now unlikely that they will take place because of the unrelenting violent clashes between vigilantes from the Christian majority and members of the Muslim minority. In addition, a question mark is now hanging over a visit to the country by Pope Francis later this month. This report by Teresa Krininger is read now by Privilege Mushindiri.
Melania Jonkra, a resident in Bangui, is seeking for answers on who to turn to as violence takes a toll on the country.
It's like we are manipulated in a way we don't understand. We ask questions, but nobody can provide an answer. Some say it's because of the French. Others say it's the Central Africans themselves who want things to continue as they are. We don't know who is going to explain to us why we are dying and for what cause.
Vengeance and retaliation are driving the violence in the capital, Bangui. Transitional President Catherine Saba Panza is concerned about the escalating retaliatory attacks. She has called for an end to the violence.
À la suite d'une embuscade suivie d'assassinat.
After the ambush and the assassination, the extremists from PK5 and their allies, who all signed the Nairobi Agreement, took revenge on the residents of the neighborhood. What followed was a cycle of revenge attacks and threats with the aim of undermining the transitional government and sabotaging the visit of Pope Francis, as well as disrupting the electoral process.
Some Central Africans are placing their hopes on elections, but a certain degree of peace and stability is required to make them happen. Yet, according to Thierry Vaclo, an expert at the International Crisis Group, even fresh elections might not be the solution to the conflict.
No, it won't be enough to bring about change. The next government may be weaker than the transitional government, and the only way to avoid that is that there will be next year a coalition government. This country can only be run by a coalition government. If this will be done, then the next government may be more effective than the present one.
Keg Sansu, an expert with the International Institute for Conflict Management, sees no way to organize election campaigns under current conditions.
At the moment, I don't know which candidate could campaign, no matter where and how. This insecurity is a major problem, and we think the international community has to put pressure on the actors and ensure discipline among them.
The violence has other repercussions too. Pope Francis' visit to the Central African Republic is now in doubt. It was planned as a last stop on his six-day Africa tour on November 29. Pope Francis voiced his concern over the situation last Sunday and called all involved parties to end the cycle of violence. He said that he might not travel to the country after all.
And that report was written by Teresa Krininger.
Behind the headlines.
And behind the headlines this week takes us to South Sudan, which is still mired in conflict despite a peace deal signed in August. President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar continue to trade accusations and counter-accusations. Last month, Machar accused Kiir of riding roughshod over the peace deal when he ordered that the number of states that make up South Sudan be increased from 10 to 28. Kiir says the new states are a response to popular demand for more decentralization. But others say it will encourage tribalism and undermine peace efforts. And those dissenting voices are not just opposition politicians. They also include members of a rather out-of-the-ordinary church choir. Fred Mavuni has the story from Simona Fulton.
This is the inter-tribal church choir youth Mama, singing for peace between South Sudan's ethnic groups. It joins members from all the major tribes who sing in different languages to spread the message. It's an important task, but the choir leader, Bishop Nathaniel Garang, says sometimes politics get in the way.
We have tribes, 64 tribes, but my dream was to bring the people together. Not politicians, they will not bring people together. They scatter people.
The work of the group was not easy before in this conflict-ridden history, but now there is a new challenge. A recent decree by President Salva Kiir to create 28 states largely along tribal lines. Instead of learning to get along and build a national identity, tribes will be administered separately. The choir fears that this will divide society further. But the decree has been well received by men of the Dinka community in Bor, the capital of John Gray State, where Youth Mama was founded. The Dinka tribal chief Ariel Aluong arbitrates on issues of cattle raiding between tribes. He hopes the new states will reduce inter-tribal clashes.
Me and everyone else here thinks it will bring peace because it will solve a leadership problem. Everyone can become the leader in his or her own area. The people who are not from here will go back to their own states.
Nevertheless, others fear that redrawing the state boundaries could give rise to new tensions. A few kilometers outside of Bor, over 2,000 Inuit are still sheltered at the UN base, afraid to come out. Matai Babuth, chairperson of the displaced Inuit community at the UN base, says the new states are not making it easier.
No Nuer will be living here in this area, either Bor or Duk. All of them, they will go back to their haunt states, and then this is seem to be a decentralization. And when you look at it, also, it is not a decentralization, it is tribalism.
The conflict has left deep scars between ethnic groups entangled in a political struggle. According to Bishop Nathaniel Garang, church groups such as Youth Mama are perhaps the only ones who can bridge the divide.
Because among the people, there are good people and there are bad people. But these good people, you can bring them together and then can make people good, all of them.
But if tribes are divided, the opportunities for interaction and hence reconciliation might be few and far between.
And that story was written by Simona Fulton. The Chinese state-run news agency Xinhua is reporting that one of China's most wanted fugitives has been repatriated from Ghana. The transfer of the suspect back to China was hailed by the Chinese authorities as an example of close cooperation with their Ghanaian counterparts. However, as Isaac Kelechi reports, there are fears in Ghana that the affair has exposed worrying gaps in national security.
According to the Xinhua news agency, the arrest of the Chinese corruption suspect has been at large for 3 years now. Zhao Ruhing was one of China's 100 most wanted fugitives. Ghanaian officials say the arrest of Zhao was a collaborative effort between the judicial, law enforcement and foreign affairs authorities of both countries after he fled to Ghana in September 2012. He is accused of invoice deception, tax evasion, conspiring with others to misuse public money and embezzlement. The Ghanaian Institute of Governance and Security supports government with intelligence services on such matters. Its head is David Agbe.
As far as we, a country, we normally receive all kinds of information from one country to another. And so if we realize that there is a fugitive, that person needs to be repatriated to his original country.
A statement from the Chinese embassy in Ghana says the suspect, who has now been repatriated from Ghana to China, is the 17th of the 100 most wanted fugitives whose names were released in April this year. The embassy won't comment further on the matter. But security expert Daniel Kondo is excited the arrest was effected for the safety of Ghanaians who might have been engaging him in business transactions. He says Ghana needs to ensure that criminals don't see the country as a safe haven.
In an era of global terrorism and insurgencies, say that his presence in Ghana posed some kind of threat to the entire society, then I'll say the collaboration was worth it. The security agencies that carried that collaborative effort out deserve commendation.
China has become a major partner for Ghana in trade and other viable sectors of its economy. This latest arrest signals how rapidly Ghana and China are growing their ties for both business and security purposes. Kondo also wants other countries in Europe to strengthen their ties with African countries like Ghana to flush out criminals threatening the interests of both continents.
Insecurity somewhere means insecurity everywhere. So there should be that kind of collaboration at all times, not only against Chinese, but all other nationals. Our country should be cooperating and collaborating with the missions and security agencies of these countries so that we can ensure global security.
International relations analyst and Ghanaian lawmaker Nana Atu Arthur isn't surprised at the close ties between Ghana and China. Ghana's parliament has passed several loans from China, while many Chinese have also flooded the Ghanaian business sector. Nana Atu Arthur says Ghana can't afford to lose China due to its immense support to the country.
You look at some Chinese in big companies working in Ghana, like the Ghana Gas Company, housing and other areas that we find Chinese helping. I believe that is in the right direction. Those ones, we should encourage them to partner us. I think that it is a good direction.
According to Chinese and Ghanaian officials, the latest arrest and repatriation of a major fugitive proves how good collaborations can do in fighting global crime.
Isaac Ledgy reporting from Accra.
Opinion.
And this is where we would like to hear your views on our top story. The government of Burundi has given all citizens who own illegal firearms until Saturday to hand them in. Otherwise, they will face prosecution under the country's anti-terrorism law. What we would like you to tell us is this. Do you think that this measure, announced by President Nkurunziza, will help to stem violence in the country? Let us know your thoughts either in an SMS to country code 49 160 957 59510, in an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or in a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. And don't forget to tune in to Your Say to hear your comments this coming Friday. Before we leave you, a reminder of our main stories. A police spokesman in Burundi said on Tuesday that 9 people have been killed in gunfights with security forces since Saturday. Violence is also casting a shadow over elections next month and a papal visit in Central African Republic. And we've also been hearing about a fugitive from China who spent 3 years living in Ghana. More stories from Africa at the same time tomorrow. Do join us if you can. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.